THE WIDE, WIDE SEA by Barbara Roden. Blue sky and white clouds above, yellow and green plains below, stretching as far as the eye could see, and brushed by the wind which never seemed to rest. No relief, no respite, no indication that either sky or plains had an end. Rolling hills tantalized with hints of what could be just over, just beyond them. False hints. Eliza, raising a weary, weathered hand to brush a limp strand of brown hair from her face, knew that if she were to make her way to the top of one of the hills, she would only see more of the same. The same sky, the same endless plains, perhaps a few trees or low bushes to indicate where water was to be found, a few brave wildflowers, harebells, anemones, prairie roses, striving to bring some color to the landscape, but none of the landmarks with which she was familiar, that had marked her world in the small village in which she had spent all her life until a few short months ago. That had been a landscape defined by man, with roads and walls and fences, fields still called by the names of people who had lived generations earlier, houses and barns that had stood for hundreds of years and might stand for hundreds more. Here there was nothing old except the land itself, and it had no names, no landmarks to which someone might point, nothing to guide the unwary or the lost. Peter was out there, breaking more of the land. Their land, the 160 acres which the government of Canada had promised to anyone who was prepared to come and start a new life in a new country. He had been mesmerized by the railway car which had appeared at the country fair near Devizes 2 years earlier, garlanded with wheat sheafs and promises of land, opportunity, prosperity in a place which was, to Eliza, as remote as the mountains of the moon. Canada was a large mass of red on the map which Mr. Jenkins, the schoolmaster, had hung on the wall of the schoolhouse with his thin white hands, part of the great British Empire on which the sun never set. When Eliza thought about Canada at all, which was seldom, she had a vague idea of mountains and snow, of trappers and hunters and explorers, of brave priests bringing the word of God to Red Indians. It had never occurred to her that people, ordinary people, might choose to live there, and when she saw the railway car she was unable to muster more than a cursory interest. She and Peter had only been officially walking out together for a few days, and she was anxious that they be seen and noted, and hopeful that Peter would comment on her new bonnet. Not that it was, strictly speaking, new, merely an old bonnet which she had turned and adorned with fresh ribbon, but she had still hoped for a compliment, or a comment about how the blue of the ribbon set off her eyes. Peter's own brown eyes, however, were fixed on the wagon. A cheerful agent, his ruddy complexion and clear eyes a testimony to the healthful Canadian air, his accent strikingly at odds with what Eliza was used to, was busy handing out leaflets to all who were interested. Peter stood, listening intently in a way that he had never managed in the schoolroom, where he had always seemed constrained, hemmed in, his clear eyes and strong body wanting to be out of doors, working, doing. He even overcame his habit of silence enough to ask the occasional question, referring often to the papers clutched in his hand. Eventually Eliza, bored, moved away towards the tea-tent, where Peter found her a few minutes later. "Look at this!" he exclaimed, holding up one of the leaflets. "Free land," it cried, "and cash bonuses!" Peter's eyes gleamed with an excitement Eliza had never before seen. "It says here—" He fumbled open the slender leaflet with his large, rough farmer's hands, and found the passage he wanted. "That the government of Canada will give 160 acres of land to any man as wants to claim it." His face filled with wonder. "Can you imagine that, Eliza? 160 acres of land, free for the taking." He shook his head. "And they say it's a grand land for growing. All you need is seed and a bit of water, and any man can have as fine a crop of wheat as you can imagine, and ready markets for it, too. Look!" He shuffled through the assortment of papers until he found the one he wanted, and held it out to Eliza, who hesitated a moment before stretching out one of her small, delicate-looking hands, of which she was inordinately proud, to take it. Emblazoned across the front were the words, "The Last Best West," and a hand-tinted image of a field of wheat stretching out endlessly under a clear blue sky until both were halted by the white border around the picture. She thought of that image now as she gazed out at the reality before her. It had looked so safe, so placid, neatly contained by the leaflet's cover, manageable, knowable. Eliza had been here for 2 months, but already she realized how wrong she had been. It had been presented to her as a promised land, but she saw now that it was more akin to Egypt under the pharaohs, a place where fire and hail, drought and insects could wipe out the work of a summer, a year, a lifetime, in an instant. She would never know this land, never feel content here the way Peter did. He did not feel the pressure of the sky bearing down upon him until he wanted to scream. He saw only the clear blue immensity of it, felt the life-giving sun. He did not feel as if he were drowning when he gazed out across the land, lost in its immensity. He only realized the opportunity it afforded, a rare chance for a man to make a new life. He did not hear the ever-present wind calling his name. He only raised his face to it, welcoming its cooling breath. And he never saw Mrs. Olson. Eliza turned sharply, suddenly, in a gesture that had become so habitual she scarcely noticed it any more, and looked back at the house which was her entire world. It stood alone and unprotected, its unweathered wood harsh against the backdrop of prairie. It might have fallen from the sky, dropped by some god's careless, uncaring child who had tired of a plaything. For a moment a vision came to her of the low stone farmhouse in which she had spent her whole life, in which the lives of generations of her family had been spent, so that every room, every piece of furniture, even the stones themselves, were as familiar to her as her own name, were infused, or so it seemed to her now, with the unseen presences of many people, of births and deaths, the commonplace, the everyday, the normal. Here, in this alien landscape, there was nothing familiar, no landmarks, nothing to guide her, nowhere to hide. She shivered, feeling exposed, naked. Nothing had prepared her for this. She had spent most of the long sea voyage in the tiny cabin which she had shared with 3 other girls, strangers all, and had seldom ventured up on deck. The first time she had done so, the vastness of the ocean had made her hang back from the railings, afraid that she would fall into those endless depths and be lost forever. A fragment of a poem that Mr. Jenkins had read to them came, unbidden, to her mind. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea, and never a saint took pity on my soul in agony. She had almost hoped that she would be seasick, so that she would have an excuse to stay safely in her cabin, a reason for avoiding the deck. But her body was as robust as always, and she had not felt the slightest twinge of sickness. She knew that this was one of the reasons Peter had asked her to marry him. He had said as much, the evening of the country fair, when he had walked her home. It was their first chance to be alone, and while he had still said nothing about her bonnet, she had wondered if he would hold her hand, or at least take her arm, when they skirted the field where Mr. Miller's bull glared out at the world from angry eyes and pawed the ground in fierce jabs. But Peter had merely said, "You aren't afraid of anything, are you, Eliza?" And she had tossed her head and said, "Of course not. Why?" Peter stopped and faced her. "Because if I do this thing, I'll be needing a wife who isn't afraid. I'll be needing a wife who's strong, who won't turn away from a hard job. Because it will be hard, I don't want to lie to you, but we'd be starting a new life, a better life than we could ever have here, in a place where there's room to breathe, room to grow, room for any man with a fire in his belly and a good strong wife by his side." Eliza caught her breath. She tried to make some sense of what he had just said, but one fact stood out clear and firm, like lightning ripping through a dark sky. "Are you asking me to marry you?" "Yes." Eliza opened her mouth to speak, but no words came. She had thought, from the moment Peter had first asked her to walk out with him, that this day would come, but she had pictured it as something entirely different. He would not go down on bended knee. That, she suspected, only happened in romances. But it would be in her parents' front room, Peter dressed in his best, at some vague point in the far future, and Peter would stammer a little, as befitted a man asking a woman to marry him, and unsure of her answer, even though Eliza knew that she would say yes, with 1 younger sister already married, and the prospect of spinsterhood looming ever more strongly before her. She had never pictured it happening so soon, though, in a darkening lane, Peter's face glowing with a passion which, the thought came and went quickly, but was there nonetheless, had more to do with the wagon and the stranger than with her. Her mind had now put his words into some kind of sense, and she realized with a shock the full implications of what he had said. He was asking her to marry him, yes, but he was also asking her to go with him to this vast new land, to leave behind everything and every one she knew, and trust herself to a place about which she knew nothing, to join him in a grand project about which they had both been ignorant a few hours before, and which, she could see, was now consuming him like a flame. An answering flame of resentment flared up within her for a moment, an anger against this place which had, in so short a time, inspired in him an ardour which she had imagined would be reserved for her. Peter was looking at her anxiously, and Eliza realized that she needed to answer. There was no time for prevarication, for coyness, for protestations of how sudden this was, even if she had been inclined to indulge in such luxuries. She knew, as clearly as if Peter had shouted it to the heavens, that he was bent on doing this thing, and that he would only ask her once. If she refused him now, or hesitated, then all would be lost, for he would see that she was not a woman who could be trusted to be strong, unhesitating, fearless. She allowed herself one quick moment of calculation, a survey of her bleak prospects, should she demur. Then she met his eyes, firmly, strongly, and said, "I will marry you," and hoped that the flame that burned inside him would one day warm her, too. Now, almost 2 years later, she stood under the pitiless eye of the prairie sun against which there was no defense, and which had turned her face, once so fair and fresh, first red and then brown. They had not married immediately. Peter had no home of his own to which to take her, and they had agreed, after due consideration and much discussion, that it would be best if they were married shortly before Peter left for Canada. He would go out alone to that new land. He did not expect Eliza to come until he had a home for her, and she had not argued, although when she said good-bye to him, her husband of 3 days, she had wondered, for a brief moment, if he had secretly hoped that she would argue with him, insist on going, on taking her place beside him, even though neither had any real idea of where that place would be, or what it would look like. It had been too late then, even had he or Eliza wanted it, and the last sight she had of him was his head looking at her from out the window of the train as it pulled away, and his arm waving before his train vanished. There began a curious, almost dreamlike year in which Eliza felt as if she were two people living the same existence, each aware of the other, but having little in common. She lived as she always had, performing her chores around the house and farm, walking to the village, sharing a room with her younger sister Jane, and there were times when she could almost feel that what had happened between her and Peter had been little more than a dream, a fancy spun out of her imagination. Then she would catch sight of the thin gold ring on her finger, and realize with a shock that she was now a married woman, her husband. The word sounded odd, almost nonsensical, like a child's made-up assortment of letters, far from her in a strange land. His occasional letters were a reminder of him, and she scanned them eagerly when they came, paying a scant heed to the details of his new life, his new home, soon to be her home, too, looking instead for anything more personal, more private, something of the man himself. But in this quest she was more often than not disappointed, and she would fold each new letter, once it had been read and remarked upon by her family, and place it with the others in the bottom of the large chest, which she was slowly filling with clothes and linens and her few personal possessions, realizing as she did so that when the chest was filled it would mark the end of all she had known of life until that point, and the beginning of another life, which she was not even sure would be her own. Occasionally, as she passed through her day, she would notice some small detail to which she had never really paid heed before, something which she had accepted as being a part of her life that would never change, and which she now realized would continue, unseen, without her. It seemed impossible, but she would look at the chestnut trees in bloom, their flowers white against the rich green leaves, or the bluebells carpeting the ground, or the red starts and nightingales nesting in the hedgerows, and think for a moment, "I shall not see this again." and the enormity of what she was about to do would well up inside her. Each detail she noticed marked the passage of time, every one reminding her inexorably that she had started down a road from which she could not turn back, and she would go back to the house and look at how full the chest now was, how little room there was in it, and realize how few were the days remaining to her in her old life. A year after Peter departed, Eliza made her own voyage, by train to Liverpool to board the Numidian, accompanied by her father, who was nervous of the city in a way that Eliza would never have suspected, and who stood twisting a large white handkerchief in his hands as he waved goodbye to her from the dockside. Then the long trip across the endless ocean, and the first blessed sight of land, of Halifax, swelling up out of the water until it filled her sight. Another train journey, longer than she had thought possible, to Montreal, and then Toronto, and then through country which at first inspired Eliza with memories of home. There were towns and villages, farms and fields, if not quite of the shape and design to which she was accustomed, then at least familiar, known, knowable. Then the train had swept north, around the great inland seas of which she had read, and slowly, inexorably, the traces of the world she had known at home, and half-glimpsed in this new land, vanished, and her only link with it was the iron rail under the wheels which bore her onward. She gained her first glimpse of the prairie when they left Winnipeg, and she pressed her face to the glass of the carriage, first wiping away the dust which streaked the windows and coated everything else with a fine layer of grit. She had been unprepared for the vastness of it. Another ocean, with an occasional town or farm doing nothing to make it seem any less implacable than the sea she had crossed. She began to have some dim sense of what she had taken on, and pulled back from the window with a small, stifled gasp. Her destination was, she knew, a place called Moose Jaw. The name had seemed impossibly foreign, even faintly exotic, in a way that Halifax, Montreal, Toronto had not, when she read of it in the Wiltshire countryside in a letter from Peter. Now it sounded almost sinister, hinting at something on which she dared not let her thoughts dwell. As the train drew into the dusty station, Eliza peered out the window into the harsh sun, looking for Peter, and for a moment did not see him. Her heart fluttered in something like panic. "Let him be here, please let him be here," she heard herself say in a low voice that almost did not tremble. And then she saw him, standing beside a curious-looking cart drawn by a pair of massive, ungainly, dirty brown oxen. And she was off the train and into his arms, heedless of the people watching and Peter's faint air of embarrassment, burying her face in his shirt so that she could block out, if only for a moment, the vast blankness which surrounded them, and that seemed to be searching for a foothold within her, the relentless wind which she could feel pushing at her, the dry, dusty air which filled her nostrils. They would not stop in the town, which seemed bustling and purposeful. Peter was anxious to be away, explaining that he wanted to arrive home before dark. "But it's only noon," said Eliza, puzzled. "How far away is our home? Can't we walk from there to town?" Peter stared at her. "It's not far," he said slowly, after a pause. "Not here, at any rate." "What do you mean, not here?" Eliza said. "Well..." There was another pause. "Things are different here, bigger," said Peter at last. "You have to realize that. Places aren't so close together. I told you in my letters that we weren't in the town. You knew that." "Yes." He had said that their house was outside town. "Not far," he had added. But she realized now that he had never been more precise than that, and she had pictured the town and their farm a short distance away, within an easy walk, certainly. The town, or some of it, visible from where she was to live, full of the promise of life and noise and people. Memories of the land she had just passed through, of that wide ocean of grass and hills stretching away forever, unbroken, untouched, made the bright day seem chill. "How far?" she asked again in a low voice. "About 20 miles," replied Peter. She stood motionless, silent, taking in those three bare words. "I tried to get land closer to town," said Peter defensively, "but it was all gone, and what was left wasn't worth having. It's a fine spot, where we are. There's water, and a few trees, and I'll plant more, soon as I have a chance, around the house, make a windbreak, and some shade. "It'll be the prettiest, snuggest spot you ever saw, Eliza, I promise." He was almost cajoling now, as if she were a child who had turned away, disappointed, from a gift that was not to her liking, and Eliza felt ashamed. He had worked so hard. She could see that in his hands, his face, the lines of his body, harder than they had been, and she knew that she had to say something to take away the hurt from his voice, his eyes. She said faintly, 20 miles. It's not so very far, is it?" Peter smiled, relieved. "Course it's not. That's my girl." He hugged her clumsily, and Eliza hoped that he would say something else, add words of comfort, anything to chase away the thoughts which were prowling the corners of her mind. But he did not, and as he turned away and busied himself with her cases, she realized dully that there was nothing he could say. She watched as her entire life was loaded into the back of the ungainly wagon, then took a deep breath and climbed up beside Peter to start the final and longest stage of her journey. The town was soon a distant blur behind them. Eliza kept turning to watch it, straining her eyes until it vanished altogether, and they were alone on the prairie. She tried to make some note of where they had come from and where they were going, but there were no signposts or markers, nothing except the road itself, a dusty, hard-packed, rutted ribbon, and the occasional homestead with small, huddled houses, a few outbuildings, and perhaps a straggling row of young trees, full of the promise of future shade and shelter, but for the moment a reminder of how recently this old land had been settled. The high clouds overhead did little to distill the glare of the sun, and all looked harsh, brassy beneath its rays, with not even the green and gold of the prairie grasses, the dark brown earth, or the occasional flowers, what looked to her like buttercups and pale crocuses, able to soften this first impression, and utterly unable to provide the familiarity which she suddenly craved. Eventually they turned off the main road onto a dispirited track that wound southwards. The houses, although Eliza could hardly think of them as such, grew more sparse, and some struck her as odd, although they were far enough away that she could not say precisely why. As each one came into view, she hoped Peter would announce that they were home, but the houses rose, then fell behind in turn as the oxen plodded on. Just as she was beginning to think that their journey was going to continue forever, Peter coaxed the team of oxen from their straight line towards a small house, what Eliza thought of as one of the odd ones, and she felt her spirits lift slightly. This, then, was their home, and she watched with some eagerness as they drew closer. When Peter stopped the cart, she sat gazing at the building, her expression puzzled. Then she turned to him, eyes wide, trying to take in what she was seeing. "It's made of dirt!" Peter, who had jumped down from the cart, looked up at her. "Sod," he corrected. "It's made of sod. They're called soddies. They're what folk build when they don't have enough money to buy lumber." "But," she tried to find words, "this is our house," she said faintly. "Made of dirt?" "Our house?" Peter looked at her for a moment, puzzled, then laughed. "No, our house is a little piece on. I just thought we'd stop and pick up a few things while we were here. This was the Olsen's place. Olsen said I could take what I needed." A wave of tiredness swept over Eliza, and suddenly she felt like crying. Nothing seemed to make sense in this land. Everything was changed. All the markers and boundaries she had known all her life swept away in a place where 20 miles was considered no distance, and houses were made of dirt, and they could help themselves to another's possessions. There were so many things she wanted to say, so many questions, but all she said was, "Why?" "Why?" Peter looked puzzled, and Eliza had to stop herself from shouting at him. "Why can we take what we want?" "Oh!" Peter scratched his head. "Olsen cleared out, went back to Sweden after his wife died. Couldn't stand being alone, he said, though I don't think he was cut out for this kind of life. Didn't know what he was getting himself into. He was having a rough time of it before his wife died. If she'd lived, then he might have made a go of it, with her and all. She were the strong one, I reckon. But after what happened, well, he just sort of gave up, and soon as spring came and the roads were passable, he up and left, said I could take what I wanted." "What happened to her? To Mrs. Olsen?" Peter paused and looked at her as if weighing his answer. "It was in winter," he said finally. "You'd not think to look at it now what the winter can be like here. The snow comes, and it's like a curtain comes down, and you can't see a hand in front of your face, it's that fierce." They walked towards the house, and Peter gestured towards a small wooden outbuilding some 30 yards away. "They had a cow and some chickens in the barn there. They had enough wood for that, but not for the house. Olsen used to make a sort of joke of it, that they lived in a soddy, but the cow had a proper house." He paused. "Don't know what happened exactly, but I reckon that Mrs. Olsen went out to the barn and got lost in the storm. There was a fierce one the day she died. I was glad enough to stay snug inside myself." Eliza stared in disbelief. But it's no more than a few steps. How could someone get lost?" Peter shrugged. "You'll see come winter," he said, and though his tone was resolutely normal, as though he were discussing something of no more moment than the likelihood of another sunny day, Eliza felt a chill strike her. "The wind comes up, and it's as if the snow was a living thing trying to beat you down. I told Olsen he should put a line up between the house and the barn as a guide, and he said he would, but he never got round to it. Near as I can figure, his wife went out and got turned round by the wind and the snow. She wouldn't have realized until she'd walked far enough to know she'd missed the barn, and then she would have turned herself round and tried to follow her footprints back, but, well, they'd have been filled in already, and she'd have been as good as blind in all that snow, just wandering, hoping to stumble across the house. Olsen found her next day, half a mile away, frozen to death." Eliza stared, eyes wide, mouth open to frame words that she could not say. "What kind of land is this that you've brought me to?" she wanted to scream. "How can anyone live here in dirt and snow and freeze to death in sight of—" Her thoughts broke off. In sight of what? In all the land around there was nothing to be seen save the dirt house and the tiny barn, and a few straggling trees in the distance that would afford no shelter, no warmth, no aid. It would be a simple matter to freeze to death here, she thought, within steps of safety. Some of what she was thinking must have been visible in her face, for Peter said soothingly, "Don't you fret, it won't happen. I'll string a line between our house and the barn nearer to winter. Long as you keep hold of that, you'll be right as rain." He glanced up at the sky to where the sun was gently dipping towards the horizon. "Best get what we want, and then we'll be off. I expect you could be doing with a cup of tea after your trip make you feel better." She looked at him for a moment, and then laughter rose up, unbidden, at the suggestion that a cup of tea would be sufficient to restore her. She saw Peter smile, and then as the laughter continued to spill out of her, she saw his face change into something wary, almost frightened, and she wondered for a moment what he could be frightened of, before she realized that it was her, or rather her laughter, which had a cracked, brittle sound even to her own ears. That look sobered her in an instant. She forced herself to stop and draw a few ragged breaths while the echo of her laughter was caught by the wind and whirled away to dance across the prairie. "I'm sorry, Peter." She did not know precisely what she was sorry for, but the words needed to be said to erase that look from his face. "I'm just tired is all." From some half-remembered place inside her, she conjured up the ghost of a smile. "A cup of tea," she said carefully, not fully trusting herself, "would be lovely." He watched her for a moment thoughtfully, and nodded. "Right then, best hurry along in that case." Eliza stood for a moment, drawing another deep breath. A sound behind her made her turn sharply, and her eyes swept the landscape. There was no one, nothing, except the wind, sighing over the bright grass, and surely it was only her imagination which had conjured her name out of a sound, as if someone had called her. She shivered once, then turned and followed Peter into the dimness of the house. Peter was proud of the fact that he could afford to build a house of wood during his first year, and Eliza had at first been reassured by it. The thought of living in a house made of dirt had appalled her. It was, she felt, something that she could simply not have borne. When she followed Peter into the Olsen house, she had felt like an animal creeping into a burrow, and had stood there uncertainly near the door, her eyes sweeping round the interior, dim despite the blazing sunshine outside. They had retrieved a few items, some cloth from which Eliza could make curtains, a few kitchen utensils, oddments of clothing left behind, the residue of a life begun in hope and ended in— but Eliza did not want to think of that. Her days settled into a routine that was not unfamiliar to her from her past life. What she could not accustom herself to was the intense loneliness of it. Peter was gone for most of the day, breaking the land with the oxen, planting, maintaining the firebreak he had erected away from the house, just in case, he had tried to reassure her. And Eliza was busy around the house. There was so much to do, and no other pair of hands to do it. There were two cows in the barn. One had been the Olsons, Peter explained, and chickens, and a half-wild cat, which stayed sleek on mice and rats, but was rarely seen. Eliza had tried to coax it into the house, but the cat had glared at her with feral eyes, and scorned her attempts at friendship. There was the house to tend, and the vegetable garden to hoe, and plant, and weed, water to be drawn and carried, and wood to be chopped and carried and stacked, and always something to cook, or clean, or mend, or make. She did not mind the hard work. She was accustomed to that. But she could not rid herself of an ache, a hunger for the company of someone or something. Even a dog would have been some comfort, but a dog was not a necessity, not yet, and in this land anything that was not a necessity was relegated to some future day. Even the sight of another house on the horizon would have been enough, she told herself, to provide reassurance that she was not completely alone, unprotected. But no such reassurance was forthcoming. She increasingly found herself stopping in the middle of what she was doing and listening, straining for the sound of something, anything, which would prove that she was not alone. It was not long before she thought she heard someone calling her name, as on the first day at the Olsons. But it was the wind, she told herself, which never seemed to end, never rested. She could see it before she felt it, watch the grasses and the crops blowing before the gust swept over her, and if she was outside she would fight an urge to drop to the ground and try to dig her way in, like an animal seeking the safety of its den. More and more she tried not to spend much time outside. The cry of the wind and the sight of the wide sea of land stretching endlessly away frightened her, and she kept her head down as much as possible, concentrating on the ground immediately beneath her feet, looking neither to right nor left. If she did not look up, she could not see how alone she was. Their closest neighbors lived 2 miles away, the house out of sight behind a fold of hill. Eliza walked over one day, not long after arriving, desperate for the sight of another person, another house, but she came away disappointed. Mrs. Riley, a hearty red-faced matron, was glad enough to see her, but was largely preoccupied with her 5 children, who ranged in age from a girl of about 10 to a babe in arms of indeterminate sex who seemed to cry incessantly. The older children were scarcely less noisy, and the change from the silence of her own house made Eliza want to clap her hands to her ears. As it was, she emerged with a violent headache and a vague, dull pain. She started the weary walk back to her house, but before she was halfway there she thought of the Olsen's soddy. The house was still unoccupied, and Eliza had a sudden urge to see it again, justifying her curiosity with the excuse that there might well be more items which would be of use to her and Peter. She turned her footsteps in the direction of the abandoned house, which looked no less forlorn than the first time she had seen it when finally it came into view, alone on the prairie. Yet as she drew nearer, Eliza realized that it seemed less of an intrusion on the land than their own home, of which Peter was so proud. The soddy was built from the land, the soil itself. It might even have grown up there, springing from the earth like the grass which surrounded it. Part of the landscape, not an imposition upon it. When she entered the soddy, Eliza was struck by how cool it was. Their own house she found stifling, with the sun beating relentlessly upon the thin roof and walls. But the soddy was deliciously refreshing, a welcome respite from the heat. She ran a hand over one of the walls, feeling the roughness. The dirt was dark and wholesome. Life-giving, she thought, not like the thin, dry dust against which she waged a ceaseless war in her own home. She glanced around the interior of the soddy, noting how compact it was, how well ordered. A few pieces of rough-made furniture remained, and a large trunk was pushed against one wall, where it had obviously served as a makeshift table. Eliza gazed at it, idly wondering why it had been left behind. Perhaps it contained his wife's things, for which Mr. Olson presumably had no need after she died. What had they been like, this couple who now existed only as names? Peter had said that Mrs. Olson had been the strong one of the pair, better suited to the life here than her husband. Would she and Mrs. Olson have been friends? The answer darted through her mind, sharp and unwelcome, that they would not have been, and she brushed it away, wondering where Mr. Olson was now. Home, she supposed, wherever that was. She felt a sudden ache at the thought. A picture arose before her, so vivid that she could almost touch and hear and smell it, of her home in England, and she closed her eyes to block out the vision and prevent the tears which she could feel rising. She felt, rather than heard, a movement behind her, and whirled round, visions of home forgotten. She was facing the door, which she had left open. Framed in the glare of the sun was a figure. A woman, Eliza thought, although it was difficult to be sure. She squinted against the sunlight, trying to make out details, but the contrast between the dim interior of the soddy and the brightness outside made it impossible to register anything beyond a general impression of someone tall and pale, silent and watchful. She uttered a tremulous, "Who is it? Who's there?" But there was no answer. Then, before Eliza could frame some faltering words of explanation or apology, there was nothing. Eliza darted to the door and swept her gaze over the land in front of her. There was no one in sight, no sign that anyone was, or had been, there, no cart or wagon or horse, nothing to break the vastness except the small barn which stood 30 or so feet off to her left, impossible to reach in the short time it had taken her to leave the soddy. Of course, if the woman had gone round the side of the house, she could even now be waiting, out of sight, for Eliza to follow. But that was ridiculous. What reason could anyone have for such an action? She had imagined the figure, that was all. The darkness within, and the light without, and her own loneliness had tricked her into thinking she had seen someone where there was no one. Her decision not to walk around the house was not inspired by fear, she told herself. She needed to start back to their house, as Peter would be back soon, and there were chores to do. She did not look back at the soddy, not even when the sound of her name was borne to her on the wind. There could not be anyone there. She asked Peter, later that evening, what the Olsons had been like, particularly Mrs. Olson. Peter scratched his head ruminatively. "Quiet," he said finally. "Hard workers. Leastways she was. They both had fair hair, like all them Swedes seemed to, and she was tall, as tall as him, with rough hands, like a farmhand's, on account of her working in the fields alongside her husband. Oh, not that he didn't do his fair share, but she were the strong one, I reckon. I saw a bit of them, what with being so close and all, and I got the feeling that coming here were her idea more'n it was his. He'd have been content to stay where they were, but she wanted something else." He stopped and shook his head. "That's why it struck so hard when she died. If she hadn't, well, then they'd have made a go of it. She'd have seen to that. But the heart just seemed to go out of him after. Terrible thing it was. He came staggering up to the house, more dead than alive, soon as the storm were over and he could get out. Don't know how he made it. He were half froze when he got here, and it were all I could do to get the story from him. Well, soon as I heard it, I knew what must have happened, and so did he. But he kept saying she were out there, waiting for him, that he could hear her calling. I never heard anything except the wind, but, well, I didn't have the heart to say that, not with him standing there, with a look on his face like he was in hell itself. The way I reckon it, he'd been in hell for a fair time, and this put the cap on it. Soon as spring came, he couldn't get away fast enough. Left most of his things behind, said I could have what I wanted, that maybe they'd bring us better luck than he'd had." It was a long speech for Peter, who generally came back from his day's work so tired that he had scant energy left to waste on words, and Eliza had listened in horrified fascination. She could picture the scene. Peter alone in the house, thankful that the storm had ended, and then the pounding at the door. Olson's story gasped out between sobbing breaths, the search for the missing woman, which could only end in one way. The broken man wanting nothing but to leave this hard land which had cost him so dear. "But he got to leave," came the thought, unbidden, to Eliza's mind. "He was lucky because he got to go home again." Her hand flew to her mouth as if she had spoken the words aloud, and Peter stared at her, puzzled. "What's wrong?" he asked. "Nothing. I was just thinking what a terrible thing to happen." "Aye," Peter sighed. "It's a hard land, no denying that. I don't blame Olson for leaving. She might have, though." "What do you mean?" asked Eliza, more sharply than she intended. Peter shrugged. "I mean that she weren't the kind to back down from a challenge. If it had been the other way round, if anything had happened to her husband, I'd wager she'd have stayed on by herself, made a go out of it, just to show she couldn't be beat. A strong woman. Just like the one I've got, eh, lass? He grinned at her. A good, strong wife. That's what a man needs here. When I asked you to marry me, and you said yes straight off, like, knowing what it meant, without having to think about it, well, I knew then and there I'd made the right choice. "'What would you have done if I'd not given you an answer when you asked?' said Eliza in a low voice. "'Why, I'd have said, "'It's no good, my girl. I can't take a wife who doesn't know her own mind off to Canada with me.' He laughed. "'But you've always known your own mind. No fear of that.' He yawned and stretched. "'Best think about getting off to bed. You too, lass. You look a bit peaky. You're not sickening for something, are you, or anything else?' "'No,' she replied. "'I'm just a bit tired, is all. "'What else could there be?' "'Well,' Peter paused and looked suddenly shy, "'sometimes women, that is, when they're going to— "'well, when someone else is on the way.' "'His voice trailed off, and Eliza realized what he meant. "'No, Peter, I'm not going to have a baby. "'Not yet, anyway. "'I just thought that— "'plenty of time, eh?' "'He rose from his chair. "'Are you coming?' "'In a few minutes, Peter. "'I have one or two things to do, then I'll be in.' "'Right. Don't be too long.' "'I won't, Peter.' "'She continued sitting after he had disappeared into their tiny bedroom, "'closing the door behind him. "'She knew that he would be asleep within moments of his head touching the pillow, "'and she sat waiting patiently until she heard the creak of the bed. "'Then she stood up and moved to the door.' "'opening it wide and passing through "'so that she could stand in front of the house "'and feel the wind upon her hot face. "'She did not mind being outside at night. "'The darkness pressing down "'was every bit as merciless as the sun. "'But at night she could not see "'the vast landscape stretching away from her "'in all directions, "'could pretend that there would be houses, "'roads, signs of life visible "'were it not for the blackness "'which shrouded these things "'and hid them from her sight. "'Peter did not feel this way.' He exulted in the land, the space, in everything that made her shrink back and pull away. Mrs. Olson would not have felt the way Eliza did. She had been strong, Peter said. The land had not frightened her. Hearing the way her husband spoke about the dead woman, Eliza knew that she could never speak of the way she herself felt, never let him know the thoughts which chased around inside her head as she went about her daily routine. She looked back at the house, silvery in the moonlight. How flimsy it was! She tried to picture the house in winter, buffeted by wind and snow, and wondered how they could hope to keep safe in so meager a shelter. She knew that it was possible to freeze to death in a house here. And what of Mrs. Olson? She had frozen to death within sight of her own house, had got lost within a few feet of safety. She had never in her life imagined a place such as this, and no one had thought to warn her of it. Not the smiling agent, who had been full of the promises of the new land, and free with pictures that did nothing to show the reality of it, and not Peter, who had never once mentioned that they were so far away from anyone, that days could pass when she would see no one but him, that a person could lose her way just a few steps from her own door, and wander the snow-browned prairie alone, unheeded, until she froze to death. Eliza felt a surge of anger, sudden and biting. At the land, at the agent, at Peter. She hated them all. They had all lied to her, or if not lied, then failed to speak the truth, to tell her how alien this place was, how lonely she would be, how she would feel the sky and the land beating down on her until she felt she had to scream and hide, find a place of safety. She wanted to scream now, scream to the uncaring heavens, to the stars shining coldly. She actually felt a scream rising, and clenched her hands so tightly that her nails, blunt as they were, dug semicircles into the flesh of her palms. A thread of movement out of the corner of her eye made her turn her head, eyes scanning the darkness. Had Peter come outside? No. The movement had been in the direction of the barn, and Peter could not have walked there without Eliza seeing him. There was no one, and nothing, there that she could see. The Eliza of 2 years ago, of the new hat and blue ribbons, would have strode to the barn to see what was there. Now, however, she began to shiver, and back towards the house, not wanting to turn her back on the barn until she was within reach of safety. She stumbled over the door-sill and almost fell, and had just enough presence of mind not to slam the door. She was glad the curtains were drawn over the windows. The thought of something looking in was unbearable. Peter was sound asleep, as she had known he would be. Quietly, furtively, Eliza undressed and slipped into her nightgown, then lay down on the bed and pulled the sheet over her, despite the warmth of the night. She wanted to move closer to Peter, cling to him, but she did not want him to wake, so she lay rigid on her side of the narrow bed, eyes closed, mouth set firm, her hands at her sides, formed into fists. At some point she slept, and was mercifully untroubled by dreams. She said nothing of this to Peter next day. Her anger had passed, leaving her feeling weary to her very bones, unrefreshed by sleep. He was out all day, breaking land for next year's planting. Every acre which he broke now would mean a larger crop the following season. When he came home, tired yet satisfied, speaking confidently of what they were accomplishing, she found she could not talk to him of how she felt, could not tell him that the vastness of the land terrified her, that she felt as if someone were watching her always, that she was desperate for human contact, the sound of voices, the sight of people and places. The only voice she heard, other than Peter's, was the one that called her name across the fields, the one which she had at first thought was the wind. But now she knew better. She knew who was calling. Mrs. Olson. She knew it was Mrs. Olson, because she had seen her again that day, standing once more by the barn, silent, watchful. She was tall and fair-haired, and Eliza knew that her hands, could she see them, would be rough and chapped from working in the fields alongside her husband. She had to, Eliza knew, because it was the only way in which all the work would get done, the only way in which her dreams and hopes would be realized. She did not see her directly. It was only out of the corner of her eye, and when she turned to look there was no one there. But she was conscious of the woman, even when she could not see her, and she found herself trying to get a closer look, pretending to ignore the figure, and then turning her head with sudden swiftness in an attempt to catch it. It was no use. Mrs. Olson moved too swiftly for Eliza to see clearly. Over the next few days Mrs. Olson was a constant presence every time Eliza went outside. She hurried about her chores as quickly as possible, seeking the solace of the inside of the house wherever she could, keeping the curtains drawn lest the face appear at the window. She wondered what she would do if the figure came into the house, then pushed the thought from her mind. That could not happen. The house was the only place left to her. If she was not safe in there, she let the thought trail off, as her thoughts did more and more often. Sometimes, when Peter was speaking to her, he had to repeat himself two, even three times before she took in what he was saying, and she often found that she had forgotten his words within minutes of his saying them. Sometimes she would look up and find Peter watching her, with a look in his eyes which worried her, although she could not say why. One afternoon, when she had gone outside to tend to the garden after putting it off for as long as possible, she had been conscious of Mrs. Olson standing by the barn, and had been trying without success to get a better look at her, when Peter's voice broke the silence with a puzzled, "What's wrong with you, Eliza?" She jerked herself upright, suppressing the cry which rose to her lips, and willing her heart to stop its frantic beating. "Peter," she said finally, when she could trust herself to speak, "You startled me." "I'm sorry, lass, thought you'd have heard me coming." He glanced in the direction of the barn. "What were you looking at?" Eliza stopped herself, following his gaze. Out of the corner of her eye she could still see the figure, tall and fair, beside the door which Peter was looking straight at. I thought I saw someone at the barn." "Ah." Peter looked from the barn to Eliza and back again. "Your eyes must be playing tricks. Anyone had been there, I'd have seen them too." "Yes." She straightened slowly, like an old woman, and turned to face the barn. There was no figure to be seen, only the blank face of the building, and the endless land stretching out behind it. Now she stood under the blue sky, looking at the endless plains, feeling the sun blazing down upon her, and wondering vaguely what she was doing there, so far from the shelter of the house, and why she felt so cold. The thought came to her, slowly, as from a great distance, that it was because of Mrs. Olson. That morning Eliza had seen her inside the house for the first time, standing motionless in the corner of the main room, and the sight had made her drop the bucket of milk which she had just carried in from the barn. She had not even tried to clean it up. Her one thought had been that her sanctuary had been despoiled, and that she must leave quickly without looking back. It was only when she had found herself 200 yards from the house that she had stopped, as if an invisible wall lay across her path. Ahead of her there was nothing but open plain. Peter was out there, somewhere, but she knew that she could not go to him, could not explain. The house was barred to her now. She could not go back, could not face what was waiting patiently inside. She thought of the barn. That was possible. She might be safe in there. She turned to look at the structure and cried out when she saw the figure of Mrs. Olson standing in front of the door to the barn, as if barring her way. It took a moment to register the fact that the woman had not disappeared when she looked full upon her, and, when the realization hit her, she screamed once, a high, keening sound. The noise was picked up by the wind, which seemed to throw it back into her face, and she thought she could hear her own name amongst the rush of sound. She screamed again, trying to form the word, "No!" But it did not come, and the dancing wind seemed to mock her, push at her, as if she were in a crowd of people all jostling her, trying to force her in the direction of the barn and the woman in front of it. She would not go there. Her feet turned away from the house and barn, away from Peter, across the grass, and she began to run, blindly, heedlessly, knowing only that she needed to get away from this pitiless land, from the emptiness that consumed her within and without. She had no clear idea of where she was going, but stumbled on, her breath coming in choked sobs, refusing to turn and look, behind her, at what might be following. She had no idea how long she ran. She only knew that she must keep moving. She stumbled often and fell more than once, but did not stop, and it was only when she saw the soddy looming up in front of her that she realized that this was where she had to go. She would find safety inside the house of earth. She could hide herself away in the cool shadows, let the land shelter her from itself. She reached the door, which was hanging open. She could not remember whether or not she had closed it behind her the last time she had been there. It did not matter. She plunged inside and stumbled over something on the floor, coming to rest against the far wall where she huddled herself into a tight ball, trying to draw ragged gasps of breath. She felt the roughness of the dirt through her dress, and turned and dug her hands into it, clawing away clods of cool brown earth. Over the sound of her labored breathing and the pounding of her heart, she heard a noise, faint as a whisper, from the door. She half turned towards it, and thought she saw a movement outside, and knew that she had been followed. She was not safe. She would be found. Her eyes darted wildly about the interior of the soddy, searching for somewhere more sheltered. Her world had shrunk to these four dark walls, and still it was not small enough. Hide. She needed to hide. Under something, behind something, inside something, where she could not be seen, where she could not see the figure at the door, darker now, more solid. It would see her in a moment. She had no time. She must be quick. No time for thought. No time. Peter found her that evening, when the harshness had gone out of the sun, and the land was bathed in a soft light which tipped the grasses with gold. He might not have seen her inside the dimness of the soddy's interior, had it not been for the dirty fringe of blue dress hanging out from under the closed lid of the trunk which, when opened, revealed Eliza's body, curled up like a broken doll, discarded by a careless and uncaring child.